Welcome back to the Bible in Context, where context is king and the original author's intent drives our interpretation. We're still in the middle of our canon series, and we're getting into the New Testament a little bit more now. And so this time we're going to be talking more about the authorship and the dating of the New Testament books. Last time we talked a little bit about the composition and the transmission of the books. You know, how were they written? Were they written by single authors or by communities of authors? And how were they transmitted forward by later Christians? What concerns did they have as they wrote those books down? And what methods did they use? So we talked a bit about that. Go listen to the last episode for some details on that. And now we need to talk a little bit more about the authorship and the date of the composition of the New Testament books. And I know we've already talked a bit about the authorship in the last episode. The reason we're bringing it up now is because we need to deal with the idea that some of the New Testament books are pseudepigraphal. Meaning, say, for instance, a letter of Paul is written by a later disciple later down the road that is not directly connected with Paul, but claiming to be Paul. That is brought up a lot in New Testament studies, if you are at all familiar with that territory. And so we just need to take a few minutes to talk about that and look at the validity of those claims, and what do we do if they're true? Because those claims make a lot of people very uneasy, and it's often used as ammunition to say the Bible is untrustworthy. So again, we're going to talk about that claim just a little bit today. Now, again, I'm sure you can tell that this is just me this time. Nate's not here, and we'll talk about this episode a little bit more next time when he gets back, but this one's going to be possibly a little more data heavy, so we wanted to just record this one separately off to the side, and then again, we'll talk about it when we get back together next time around. So during this episode, I'm going to be leaning pretty heavily on a work by Jonathan Bernier called Rethinking the Dates of the New Testament. I hope I said his last name right. I think it's Bernier, but it's B-E-R-N-I-E-R, for those of you who want to look that work up. Really great work. It's pretty new. And he pushes back against the school of thought that says the New Testament letters should all be dated very late and outside of the lives of the supposed writers. And he really makes a good case for dating the New Testament letters very early and inside the lives of the apostles that are writing them. And we'll be getting a little bit into some of the criteria that he goes through to talk about why a lot of those who say the New Testament writings are written very late are actually based on methodology that isn't all that well thought out in the grand scheme. Really, there's been less research done in the area of the early and late dating of the New Testament letters. There's just been a few people who have really looked into this area of New Testament studies. And then after that, it seems like a lot of later scholars just took the words of those previous scholars as the authoritative word on that topic without really challenging, interacting, or nuancing their arguments as they move forward. So that's what he is doing. He's saying, look, we need to reevaluate their methodology because it hasn't been done in this generation all that much. And as he evaluates their methodology, he is able to kind of show how some of these thinkers that have previously addressed this topic had, again, some gaps in their scholarship. As, I mean, it's true of any generation of scholarship. We learn more, we can apply new data, update our methodology, and get better results from our scholarship. So that's what he's doing in this book. And I'm sure there will be some pushback at some point advocating for a late date again in light of his research. But his book has been taken as something that has to be wrestled with if you're going to get into the topic of the dates of the New Testament writings. So really good book. I encourage you to check it out if you're interested in that topic. But we'll go ahead and dive into the authorship of the New Testament writings and, again, take a look at some of those criteria for potential pseudepigraphy. Now, one thing I was going to do was read through some of the dates in his book for the New Testament writings, but who wants to listen to that on a podcast? I decided to not do that and just list off a bunch of dates and numbers that you're not going to remember. Again, you can get the book and take a look at it if you want to. But a large thrust of what he is doing is showing that the books of the New Testament were all written well within the first century, many of them in the mid-first century. And again, all of these within the lives of the apostles and the supposed authors of these writings, with exception to a couple where he says that we don't have enough data to conclusively say these are not pseudepigraphal. And I appreciate that, and I think you should too, just because he's not trying to argue for the authenticity of these letters. Authenticity meaning that the person who said they wrote the letter is the person who wrote the letter, like Paul actually wrote the letters that he put his name on versus someone else putting Paul's name down and saying that Paul wrote the letter whenever it was someone else. So he's not arguing for the authenticity of these letters for the sake of principle. He's arguing for a reconsideration of the dates of the New Testament writings based on more well thought out methodologies. And so we should appreciate there that he is being fully honest with the data not trying to advocate for certain views on principle, and again, just not attend properly to the data. And because he's saying there's a couple letters that could potentially be pseudepigraphal, I want to also be responsible with the data and not just set out to prove that all the letters are authentic, but rather I want us to grapple with what if there are some pseudepigraphal writings in our New Testament? How does that affect our reading of them, our view of their authority, and their reliability to convey the events and tradition of Jesus's life and mission and so on? Because while all these letters may be authentic, if there is a way for them to fit into the framework of being a reliable vehicle of the tradition of Jesus, then I think we should wrestle through that and think about it. Because if it so happens that, yes, there are some pseudepigraphal writings in our New Testament, we need to understand how that does not destroy the truths of the Bible, because I don't think they do by any stretch of the imagination, because that will, first of all, be used as ammunition by those who want to disprove the Bible or have a predisposition to say the Bible is not true. And it will also be something that will be a challenge for those who have not wrestled with this topic already, as they try to trust Scripture in light of learning that, oh, there's a pseudepigraphal book in the New Testament. So again, it's good for us to wrestle through these things so that we can have an answer for ourselves and for others when this is raised, and we can also help those who are also being challenged in their faith because of what they're being told is dishonesty within their Bibles. Okay, so what New Testament books are often claimed to be pseudepigraphal, to have inauthentic authorship? Well, that would be 1st and 2nd Peter, Titus, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, James, Jude, 2 Peter, and 2 and 3 John. Now that's 11 of our 27 New Testament books. Again, these are just ones that have been examined in the past critically to say that they are inauthentic. That doesn't mean that all of these books are agreed upon as being pseudepigraphal, but those are the ones that are usually under consideration for pseudepigraphy. And so again, we're going to talk about some of the criteria for why these books are considered to be pseudepigraphal by some. So the reasons that these are typically said to be pseudepigraphal, to be inauthentic, is because they include differences in style, literary style, differences in vocabulary, different word choices throughout the letter, different theological themes highlighted, and this is all when compared to other writings from that same author. So what they'll do is they'll take some letters from Paul that they all believe are authentic to Paul, and then they'll compare the style, the vocabulary, and the theological themes that are highlighted to some of these other letters that are in question. And if they're different, then they say, oh, this must be someone else, because one person clearly cannot use two different styles, use different vocabulary to describe similar veins of thought, can't highlight different theological themes. Those are kind of some of the criteria. You already kind of hear some of the doubt over these criteria in my voice, I'm sure. But frankly, if you sit down and think about it, these criteria, they're a little silly. We'll dive into these in a second, because there's one more criteria that's often looked at, and that is the structure of church organizations and church hierarchies in the letter. If there's a mention of certain church hierarchies, such as, you have deacons and elders and bishops and so on, if you see mention of certain structures in certain letters, they say, oh, this must be from the second century instead of the first century. There's no way that a church was organized this way as far back as Paul's lifetime. And so this clearly must be a later letter that someone else wrote in Paul's name. Now, let's talk about these first couple of criteria, the style and the vocabulary. This is something where, yes, if there are differences between the style and vocabulary of different sections or different books that are all supposed to be by the same author, there is a reason to stop and say, wait a minute, why is this different? However, to say that this cannot be the same author, to say that they have not aged or grown or changed their style or changed the vocabulary that they used, or they're trying to address a new situation where they think that a different style and different words with different nuances better fit this scenario. To say that none of that can happen and that this can't be the same person, to conclude that based off just that data, again, that's why I called this a little bit silly. If you sit and think about this, it really is weak data for saying that this cannot be Paul's writing because of these stylistic differences. Now, the theological themes, one that you'll see brought up is in one letter, Paul highlights the resurrection a lot, and this one over here, he highlights the death of Jesus a lot, and so these must be from different authors. There's no way that one guy can highlight different theological themes or different points in Jesus's life in two different letters. Again, it's just kind of silly. There could be different situations that he's wrestling with, or perhaps a little bit of time has elapsed between the two letters, and he thinks that, okay, I want to highlight this aspect this time because it's on my mind more. It's more fresh. I can make good points with this. We do the same things in our lives. Humans are not monochromatic. We do not remain stagnant throughout the course of our lives. We change. We update the ways that we talk. And we can still make the same points and still convey the same truths through, again, different styles and through highlighting different aspects of the truth we want to talk about. So, again, just not great criteria for trying to decide whether or not a book is authentic or not. Now, the last one is the church structure issue. And this one's a little bit interesting because it relies on some reconstructions of church history that we just don't have a lot of data for. Bernier shows that really we don't have a lot of information about church structure in the early centuries. And so to try and assign certain church structures to certain early centuries of the church is just not something that we have the data to do. And then on top of that, to try to fit all of these different quote-unquote offices into a unified structure that spans the different churches in the whole region of Asia Minor that Paul is going to and speaking to is a bit of a stretch. There may be differences in the way these churches are organized. They are house churches. They are pretty ad hoc. They are just suiting the needs of the people that they have. And so you may have different structures based on the location and the culture that you are in. The titles that Paul is using to describe these church offices, quote-unquote, may be very loose terms or have very loose job descriptions, if you want to put it that way, such that it's just something put together in that particular community to suit the needs of that community, even if it looks different everywhere. So again, we can't make a whole lot of assumptions about what church structure looked like in the first century based on the biblical data, and we don't have very good data to make claims about the structure of the church in the second century as well. So really, to try and date the letters based on the words Paul uses to describe church leaders is just not a very good criteria to use. It doesn't really give us much information. So far, I've talked about problems with dating the books of the New Testament, and especially problems with assuming a late date based on some insufficient criteria. How does Bernier date the books of the New Testament and other New Testament scholars as well? How do they reconstruct the dates of these New Testament writings, aside from just assuming that certain authors wrote them and so it must be within their lifetime? And it's really cool because in this book, he actually gets pretty detailed. There's a couple that he nails down to, you know, just a couple of years or even a particular year that this book is written. A lot of them he nails down to say these books are probably written within a certain decade or so. But how does he do that? Well, he takes those books, and the first thing that you always look at when you're dating a writing is look at the first reference to that writing outside of the New Testament or in another writing. So if we have early church fathers like Ignatius or somebody like that referencing that book, it has to be written before Ignatius. Right now I'm referencing, you know, Bernier's book. And so obviously that book must be written before the date of this podcast release. So that's kind of how that works. So he uses that criteria to say that these books must be written before this point. So he's looking at the earliest references to the New Testament text to show the very latest that they could have been written. He's looking at the relationship that the New Testament texts have to one another. If there is one that borrows language from another book within the New Testament, then those two have a chronological relationship. One must be first and one must be later. For instance, a lot of scholars will presume that Mark came first, and then Matthew and Luke have so much material from Mark because Mark came first. So therefore, if you establish a date for Luke, Mark has to be before that date. So looking at things like that, I'm looking at what stage of the journeys throughout the New Testament a letter was written within, looking at the people that are mentioned and where else they show up. And again, using all these factors to construct a reliable story about when and where these letters and these narratives were written. There are a couple letters that Bernier think might be pseudepigraphal, and so he leaves that option open for 2 Peter, for 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus. And so really the reason is all of the criteria that I've mentioned for how he dates the New Testament letters, and again, as well as I can transfer that into audio for a podcast, trying to be very brief and give an overview. Really, there's just not enough evidence to really nail down where these were written, and so there's not enough evidence to conclusively say this was written within Paul's lifetime, and so again, he just leaves open the option of it being pseudepigraphal, because there's that possibility just purely based on the data. Though on the other hand, it can't be proven that they are not authentic, because the contextual data of those letters could easily place this letter back within the lifetime of the apostle as well. So there's just not enough evidence to say either way. There's also not enough evidence to disprove either option. 2 Peter, that one's especially difficult just because it relies so heavily on Jude. People see that as a very crucial evidence in showing that it is pseudepigraphal because it borrowed from an earlier biblical book being Jude and repackaged it for 2 Peter. But again, that's not concrete either, just because the author of 2 Peter could have easily have been Peter working closely with Jude or something like that, or trying to convey the same ideas. Or again, you know, using an amanuensis to take down the same idea and construct these very similar ideas into different letters going to different places for different needs, even though a lot of the content can be the same. Again, there are certain ways to understand a relationship between 2 Peter and Jude, where 2 Peter is written within Peter's lifetime and written by him, whether he's borrowing from Jude or working with Jude or however you may have that. However, now I want to talk about the possibility that they are pseudepigraphal, that they are inauthentic. They are not actually written by Peter or by Paul for 2 Timothy, Titus, and 1 Timothy. Because as I've said, I think I want to address this topic. I want to deal with this topic so that if these are actually pseudepigraphal, you know, I don't really have a stake in whether or not they are, because I think there are cultural factors that can allow these books to remain authoritative, yet also be pseudepigraphal. And so I don't really care either way, but we need to deal with this so that those who may have doubt cast on their faith because of someone who brings up the potential pseudepigraphy of some of these New Testament texts is not shaken by that fact. And I really just don't want to slam my fist down and say, you know, these cannot be pseudepigraphal because it's the Bible. It has to be authentic because it's the Bible. And then, you know, come to find out that I was wrong. People, and they say, well, I'm going to throw my hands up, you know, now that we know that these are pseudepigraphal, and say that the Bible's false because of this fact. When, in fact, the pseudepigraphy of some of these letters can fit within the framework of still understanding the Bible as authoritative and inspired. And really the first thing just to address there is the fact that those reading 2 Peter, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, and really the other books as well that are considered to be pseudepigraphal by scholars who advocate for a late dating of a lot of the New Testament texts. If you were to cut those 11 books out of the New Testament, you know, I mean, that's a lot of the New Testament, but if you did, would you be missing out on any vital truths? As again, we've advocated on this podcast, no, because all of the later texts of the Bible are outworkings of the truths of the Torah. And then you have the New Testament where you're shown how Jesus is the fulfillment of the hopes, the promises, etc. of the Torah, and then those same hopes and promises which were expounded by the prophets and the writings. And then the rest of the New Testament is showing how do we faithfully live out the truth that Jesus is the fulfillment of all those things from the Old Testament. And so it is all wisdom growing out of the same truth, not new truths which are being discovered. It's rather just the application of that truth in different situations. So again, those are crucial books. They're very good. I'm not saying that we should cut them out. I think we should keep them in. But in the worst case scenario, if you're convinced that they're inauthentic and so you can't trust them anymore and you're not convinced that they can be trusted, you're not going to miss out on the message of Jesus. So I just like to throw that out there because worst case scenario, we have not lost the core truths of the gospel or any truths of the Bible. Now, I believe last time I mentioned that it is possible that disciples may have, not disciples of Jesus, but say disciples of Paul or of Peter or something like that, may have tried to write in his stead to continue the tradition that he conveyed in a new scenario. That's a lot of what New Testament scholars will talk about for these letters. They'll talk about the fact that if these letters are pseudepigraphal, it may have been a representative of the school of Peter or of Paul trying to write in his stead to fill a void for a new situation. And so therefore they're reliably conveying the tradition of, you know, Peter and Paul and the tradition that they relate about Jesus. And that would be kind of analogous to asking someone today about some World War II stories where they probably heard those from their grandfather or something like that, or maybe even a great grandfather that they had that story passed down for a couple generations. And so, you know, you would expect that in that case, there would be some reliability to the story that they are telling. Now, take that and also realize that this is the scriptural tradition related to the king of the world that was regarded very highly. And so you're also going to put a lot more work into memorizing that story, that tradition, the truths of this master, than you're going to put into memorizing your grandfather's war stories, as important to you as those may be. So there should be a high degree of reliability between the teacher, Peter or Paul, and a couple generations down the line of their disciples. And that's really the core of why these New Testament writings are authoritative, even if they are inauthentic. Now, the early church did look at the authenticity of letters to determine whether or not a letter is reliable. If they determined that a letter was inauthentic, that the original apostle did not write it, they would say, yes, this is a pseudepigraphal writing, a heretical writing. We don't want it. We're not gonna read it. And so maybe the early church got it wrong on a couple letters, or maybe they actually did a good job and got it right. Again, we just don't have the data to say definitively, and so I'm writing that line and don't really care much either way, honestly. But even if they did get it wrong in this case, and these books were pseudepigraphal, what they did do is they recognized that these books reliably conveyed the tradition that the rest of the New Testament conveyed about Jesus. And so they saw these books as in line with that tradition and therefore useful for teaching, for reproof, rebuke, and encouragement and equipping and all those things. So ultimately, whether these books are pseudepigraphal or not, and again, I think there's a good case to be made that a vast majority of them are not, maybe just those last four have the possibility of being pseudepigraphal, but even still, the data is just not conclusive, and so it very well may be that all these works are authentic, and the early church got it right that these works were all authentically from the apostles they say they're from. But even if they're not, it's been recognized that they are in line with the Jesus tradition that was handed down from the apostles, and so therefore we can read them with confidence that they are reliable, trustworthy, and can, again, equip, reprove, rebuke, encourage, equip for being part of Jesus's people. That is really what this pseudepigraphy issue comes down to, I think, if you're trying to understand if these books can still be trusted if they are pseudepigraphal, when frankly we just don't have the answers, and we have enough very smart voices saying that they might be pseudepigraphal. So that's something we need to think about. Now, there's one more thing that I need to bring up that I should have brought up probably towards the front of this conversation, but that is just the fact that pseudepigraphy was a common genre at this time, especially in Second Temple Judaism. And so it may be that this was just part of this culture and not really seen as a lie. I think that's a lot of what gives people a rub too, is that they see pseudepigraphy and inauthenticity as someone trying to deceive the church. Well, first of all, that doesn't seem to be the case because of the content, because it's in line with the rest of biblical doctrine. And so if they were trying to deceive, they would not give a new application of old truths. They would try to put in new truths in a way to confuse and deceive people. That doesn't seem to be the intent just based off the actual texts. Now, again, it was common to take historic characters from the past and to use their names in your story to give a sort of authenticity, some sort of authority. Just like today, if you were going to tell a story about the revolution, you might pick a character to tell that story for you. You might say that you were telling the story from George Washington's perspective or something like that to give the story some feel of authenticity, even though everyone knows that George Washington is long dead. No one's going to think that it's a lie. They're just going to realize it's a rhetorical, literary device, something to give your story some flair, something like that. That may be what's going on here. Again, where these disciples are, with good intentions, trying to use the name of their master and trying to stay within the confines of their master's teaching to help someone in a new situation, even though that master, Paul, Peter, whoever, is gone. So there is at least some cultural backing to say that this was not just for sure a lie of deception if this is pseudepigraphy, but this may be part of a normal cultural convention from a well-intended and intelligent disciple who can reliably convey the Jesus tradition that they got handed down from their apostolic master. Okay, so I hope that was helpful. That was, again, I feel like quite a bit. It's a hard topic. We're just briefly covering a lot of issues surrounding it, but I just want to get us comfortable with the idea of New Testament pseudepigraphy, just again so we can wrestle with it, whether it's true or false. We at least have answers to understand why it does not throw doubt on the New Testament, even if it makes you a little bit uneasy to think of it in this way. But just something to sit with, to think about. Again, I recommend getting Bernier's book. It's not really a devotional book that will try to lead you back to the authenticity of Scripture. He's mostly just arguing for the dates of the New Testament based on the data, but it's a good book. All right, well, next time we will jump into the selecting of the New Testament texts and how we got the books that we have and how we should think about that process of the books coming into what we have as our New Testament. And then we'll talk a bit more about some of the text critical issues and the reliability of not just the books that were chosen, but of the texts that have been preserved for a couple thousand years now.